they weren't allowed in.
It had to, hadn't been built for accommodation of ladies. It didn't have to make the 70s. But the, primarily, they would be in the next, on the occasion when you're having a ball.
Mm-hmm. Which wouldn't happen too often.
Which wouldn't happen too often, no.
Let me ask you a further question on the same idea. Married officers were required how often in the mess for dinners?
I would say only when there was a dining in night or a guest night.
Mm-hmm.
And in other words, they would not be required more frequent than once a week.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes less frequently. But very often they were in the mess. Often in that.
Probably for a cocktail or something before going home. Or
yeah, so I would come over there.
Play some billiards?
Yeah, and play some bridge, something like that. Yeah. I set out to tell you something here, and I'm rather vain of me. I digress there and speak about the Mary Porter. How do we start this conversation now?
Oh, we're still talking about rules, regulations, and mess, or are we?
Yeah. Well, let's come back to the mess and life in the mess now.
You were going to talk about the married quarters, the old 28th, one of the old 28th.
Yeah, well, I did. I was talking about that, and,
Well, let's go back to the mess, and then probably...
Yeah, let's go back to that. Okay. let's look at it from the point of view of a junior officer. I suppose it was natural that, the officers in the mess tended to congregate a little bit, depending upon their experience and background. The junior officer naturally trying to live amongst his own junior officers in the mess as a group, and the older ones in there tend to stick together. I set out to tell you a little bit about the disciplining, not so much disciplining, but the effort to train the young officer in the ways of mess life and make them conscious of the rules.
Mm-hmm.
There were others who took it upon themselves to, as part of the upbringing of a young officer, to make them good card players. It was considered a good social asset to be able to play bridge well.
Would you play other games as well, other than bridge, or with
bridge? Yes, but bridge was primarily the game of the mess. And Lieutenant Monsley, for example, at Camp Borden, and later at Trenton, he undertook to see that the junior officers knew how to play bridge and knew how to play bridge well, and he was a really first-class card player.
Mm-hmm.
He would teach them a bit about poker too, if you've got to play poker, but poker was not one of the recognized mess games. It was rather frowned upon in mess because of the
gambling connotation.
Yeah, and gambling connotation. Bridge was really the recognized money game. If you want to play for money, you play bridge.
Mm-hmm.
But you were required by the custom and the regulations of the mess to enter your winnings or your losses in the bridge book.
Mm-hmm.
And that bridge book was there for the inspection of the senior officers of the base to see if nobody was getting hurt
too much.
Yeah, and the losses weren't too great. The commanding officer, particularly Camp Borden, Wing Commander Croyle, he kept a pretty close eye on things like that to see that nobody was getting too deeply into debt. And of course, you couldn't get too deeply into debt playing bridge. But nonetheless, $25 in those days was a lot of money, and that was more or less your limit.
Well, how much
if you lost one night, you were cut off for the rest of the month.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, how much would you be making a month?
Oh, around $200. Mess bells were supervised, were scrutinized too. Commanding officer kept a close eye on the mess bells because on the mess bell, not only were your wins and losses, but your bar consumption. And your consumption of them was high, you heard about it.
Especially a younger officer, I would think.
Especially. Yeah. yeah. And of course, there are other things that put your bill up, long distance telephone calls and things like that. And we had one officer at Christmas time one year phone to London. In those days, phoning to London, phoning transatlantic was an uncertain business and fairly costly. And it was very difficult to get through at times. Because Christmas was no time to phone and propose to your intended. What line? What? what? wires were available? were loaded, overloaded, and he was the lad who was trying to drink a bit much, and he wasn't overloaded when he tried to make that phone call himself, but he got so frustrated trying to get the call through that by the time he did get through. He wasn't sober, and he talked for a long time without getting around to what he intended to say, and I think he forgot completely that he was going to propose. his telephone bill was $127.
Oh, the poor
lad. Who else kept an eye on things in the mess?
Would the PMC keep an eye on things?
Oh, yeah, the PMC's function was to do that. Well, we talked about the original mess that I belonged to and lived in, but of course the messes were rather vulnerable to fire.
Mm-hmm.
One of the jobs of the orderly officer every night in the week was to go around after the mess closed and make sure there were no cigarette butts accidentally down behind the seat cushions and the chester fields and things like that. And particularly after mess dinner.
Mm-hmm.
But that mess did burn down. And I can't remember whether it burnt down after yesterday or not. I wasn't there at the time.
What year would it have burned down in?
About 1930.
Shortly after you had left, I guess.
Yeah. Around 1930. And the orderly officer was the only one not in left yet. He had his regular blue uniform on, and his band on his arm was that old orderly officer. And he had to do not only the rounds of the mess, but the rounds of the station inspector there and down the hangar lines and so on to keep an eye on things and make sure they're very conscious of fire.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah, speaking of fire, of course, Camp Borden had a voluntary fire department. Another job that the junior officer had was to act as fire chief, and some of them had to act as supervisory firemen. Everybody had a job, you know. These were important aspects of one's early career training.
Mm-hmm.
Simon was a fire chief in those days, and he loved to get dressed up in that big white raincoat and that white fireman's hat.
Was there a fire truck or anything?
Oh, yes, there was a fire truck. Of course, you had to on an air base.
With the crashes.
And have good fire equipment. And I think this was pretty antiquated fire equipment, really, but there were fire trucks. So. All right, we are...
Well, back to the mess. Were there any regulations directly regarding alcohol? You mentioned the keeping eye on mess chips, but what could be drunk, what couldn't be drunk?
No, I can't recall any regulation of that type. You mean what whether junior officers were only permitted beer or something like that, as opposed to having a full range of spirits.
Something like that, or would wine have to be decanted, or they could be drunk.
That sort of regulation applied to the other ranks, but not to the officers. The officers are supposed to learn to handle themselves properly.
Were there any things that had to be drunk at a certain time, like port after dinner?
Oh, well, yes. Yeah, there were customs there. Yeah, that's interesting to know. For example, the pre-mess dinner drink was a standard drink, whether you liked it or not, and that was sherry. A lot of these customs have come to us from the
British court.
And of course, sherry was easy. If you had a group of 20 or 30 people at mess dinner or more, you could bring in a big silver tray with a lot of sherry glasses on, pass them around rather quickly.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if you were trying to serve drinks that people drink these days, it takes a while to mix them up.
Yeah.
So there was some good justification for having a drink like sherry. Another thing, in that same time frame, before the dinner, smoking was not permitted. There was no smoking whatsoever in the mess.
Mm-hmm.
Either in the ante room before dinner, or in the dining room at dinner, you couldn't smoke until the toast to the queen had been drunk. That was a signal that you could drink.
To relax and...
and there's a very good reason for that. That stemmed from a naval custom. We drew our customs in the Air Force from both the Navy and the Army, having been formed from the RFC and from the Royal Naval Air Service.
Mm-hmm.
In the Navy, in the smaller ships of earlier days, the ante room and the wardroom, the wardroom and the dining room, I guess, were practically one and the same thing. The dining room was just off to one side.
Yeah.
If you permitted smoking before dinner, you'd fill the small area with smoke.
Yeah.
If you permitted smoking during dinner, it would do the same thing. So
mm-hmm.
that was the basis of this.
You would find
in the Army messes in Canada,
mm-hmm.
they didn't have that regulation. They hadn't had this naval influence.
Yeah.
And they rather thought that we were a bit queer.
Would you like to stop? Because you
yes, stop for a moment. I get a drink.
Okay, we're back. Now, I wanted to ask you about, we're sort of progressing to drinks through dinner.
Yeah.
What could one drink at dinner? Was it wine? Did you have a choice?
Mm-hmm. At dinner, you drank wine. And I can't recall at Camp Borden whether we had a choice of wines. I think that there was perhaps a wine chosen to suit the menu of
mm-hmm.
the evening, and you would drink what was chosen for you. The bar officer and the mess secretary and the mess pres all considered themselves wine connoisseurs, and they didn't know a damn thing about it really, but they were the ones who chose, and they undertook to educate people in the mess on what was good wine and what wasn't.
Because France is supposed to be a good wine.
Yeah, that's right. There weren't any Canadian wines in those days to speak of.
Any California?
No. There was a bit of New York wine, but the wines that we would be concerned with would be imported French wines.
I suppose after dinner, the port...
You're at the table here.
Okay.
I was going to say unwritten laws. It may have been written, I don't know. Was at a mess dinner. And generally speaking at the mess, whether you're dining formally or informally in the mess, you did not speak or talk about women or sex or politics or religion.
Well, what about shots? Planes and whatnot. Could you talk about that?
When you made the exclusions I've just made, it didn't be much shot.
Especially not for the company of men, because the first thing that you would think of, I would think, would be women.
Yeah.
That would be the first topic of conversation.
And there are certain penalties invoked in the Mass at a Mass dinner. Yes, this might be the news to you. If you infringe some of these rules and customs, you could be penalized.
Monetarily?
Yes, yes. Let me see, what sort of thing is a penalty? Well, if you were talking out of turn and discussing some of the taboos, you could be penalized around a drink.
Mm. Which could get rather expensive, I think.
Yes, that definitely could. If you broke a glass at the man at the table, you rather carelessly broke or clumsily broke a glass, you generally paid 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 or 7 times the price of that glass, the price of that. There were tricks played with glasses, you know, those 10 glasses at the table.
Mm-hmm.
And if you were clever, you could flip them up and turn them down without breaking them. And sometimes, my young Alex would play this game at the table. But they knew if they lost or broke, they would generally go 7 times the cost of the island.
Gambling, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, well,
were there any serious breaches that one could make in a mess? Or anything that you can recall someone doing that went beyond that?
Serious breaches. Well, yeah. To get yourself inebriated to the point where you're non-compass was a serious breach.
Mm-hmm.
Did
that happen very often?
To get yourself so bored with with a normal nest life where you threw a teacup at the wall or something like that. Considered a breach. I remember one day when I was first at Kent Borden, Dave Harding was there. He was a famous chef. He was a great athlete. He had played for Queens on that famous Queens football team, which was the greatest team in Canada for years.
Mm-hmm.
Dave was a very exuberant type, and he found the atmosphere in the mess at tea time a little bit studious. And I remember one day he took a teacup at one end of the anteroom and cast it the full length of the room, aiming at something down there at the other end of the room. Just in rear and fun. That just livened things up a little bit. On other occasions, somebody took a weapon and fired at those model aircraft hanging from the those incidents, of course, are very rare, but...
What would have happened to both of the two gentlemen? Would they have been penalized in some way?
Well, Dave Harding was such a likable fellow that I don't think he was perhaps not penalized more than a multiple of the cost of the cup.
Mm-hmm.
Like that.
And all the money, I suppose, would go into the next fund.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Then there were other penalties that I should perhaps mention. And this doesn't have to do directly with social life, but it does in some ways. There was a rumble club at Camp Borden.
A rumble?
A rumble. And the rumble club, you were rumbled if you did something that was wrong. A rumble would cost you a certain amount of money.
Mm-hmm.
For example, if you undershot coming into land and had to use your engine. We always landed without engine.
Mm-hmm.
With the engine just idling over.
Mm-hmm.
If you had to use your engine to drag yourself in over the ridge at the edge of the airfield, that was a rumble. And you're penalized for that. If you got your name in the paper, you know, we were sort of a strong silent service like the Navy in those days. And if you got your name in print, that was a costly rumble. You weren't supposed to. you weren't supposed to be involved in any publicity.
Or what if it was simply an announcement saying that the son of so-and-so, would that be a rebel?
No, no. But if you did something that, through your own action, got you into the public eye, you'd be rumbled. I can't think of it. There are all sorts of little things that cause the rumble. Now, this is peculiar to Camp Borden. I don't think it happened to other places. It was a local custom. Mm-hmm. It added a little bit of spice to life. One thing we haven't talked about I think you didn't mention music. There's always a reasonably good piano in that. And the piano was an important feature of the mess, you know, because in those days there was still quite a bit of singing done at functions. Mm-hmm. Back in the days before, certainly before radio and before radio and TV, you had to make your own entertainment, and singing was one of the recognized forms. And the mess in there always there's always somebody at the piano. To be able to play the piano was much more common in those days. Mm-hmm. To be able to sing well was more. To sing was more general than it is now. And you would sing. Well, depending on who was at the piano, I started singing. It was the old Brookie. I mean, Brooks was the keenest one on singing. Now, Brookie was the one who didn't. He wasn't against drinking, but he took a dim view of the office dogging too much, and he felt that there's nothing like a good sing song to keep the boys from drinking too much. So he'd gather a lot of people around the piano, and there would be some really good singing on the popular songs of the day, or the mess songs of the service.
Were the songs that were peculiar to Canadian pilots, Canadian flyers, that sort of were handed down to you?
There were songs that were peculiar to the Air Force that were handed down from the RFC and the RNAS. And
do you remember any of the names of them?
I don't think they went by name, but some of them were oh yes, one was the pilot's lament, and it was the song of the dying pilot in the crash overseas during the war.
Do you remember it?
And it went something like, and I can't remember it now, but I remember take the crankcase out of my liver and something out of my brain. And something and something something as I sing this last refrain.
Thank you.
Yeah. Well, there are a lot of songs of that nature. Some of them are pretty ribald.
So in particular.
Yeah. And Brookie was pretty good. He had a good voice, and he was a good singer. But he never stopped talking. Everybody had a nickname in those days. His nickname was the Babbling Brook. And funny enough, he had no, and I suppose this could happen, nickname that was derogatory. You might never hear it yourself. Mm-hmm. Everybody else had known about it, but you would know it yourself. And at his farewell mess dinner when he was retiring, Bart Simon was the chief of the air staff at the time, and he was this mess dinner was at Ottawa, at the headquarters mess, across the street mess in Ottawa. And it so happened that there were about five or six old-timers retiring on this occasion. They were all head table guests, and Simon was very good on his feet. And he, in introducing the head table guests, he told a little story about each one, and he undertook to tell the nickname of each of these retiring officers. And when he got to Brookie, he said, and of course everybody knows the nickname of George Airy Brooks. Brookie by this time was Mayor And it was the Bab McBrook. Well, you know, Brooke, you say still. He was pleased to be referred to as the Bab McBrook.
Oh, it's such a nice nickname. It's not too derogatory about it.
No. Well, I think he was momentarily
surprised. I guess he was surprised. Well, let me ask you this, and this might be digressing even farther than I usually do, but you said that everyone had a nickname. What was your nickname? Or did you have one?
I don't know.
No one told you.
Funny enough, I don't. I suppose I had. But that'll have to come emerge some later day.
I'll have to find someone who knew you were fine.
Music. Dances. Now, we haven't talked about balls. Mm-hmm. When a ball took place at a place like Camp Boyden and applied to other stations, too, it was a big affair. It was rare. It was a rare event. It was rare at Camp Borden because Camp Borden was isolated. I had to import the girls to Toronto or Kingston or distant places. There was no hotel there, no place for them to stay. So the married officers had to
bunk in with
the married officers had to invite the girls of the single officers to stay with them. Mm-hmm. And everybody rallied around. Of course, you made your own social life in a place like that, and this was part of doing it. And I remember on one occasion we had two girls from Kingston, Ontario. They came to Kingston in the summers, but they were really Texans. And one of them was being brought to the mess dinner by Flying Officer Miller, who later became Air Chief Marshal Miller and the Chief of Defense Staff. Immediately after Charles Fuchs. Mm-hmm. And the other was Bob Cameron, who later became Air Vice Marshal Cameron, who was flying off in those days. Those two girls married those two Air Force officers. So we had sisters in there. And I think we had a third. No, I guess that we couldn't accommodate three. We had these. There was only one spare bedroom in these little quarters. And we had two girls. There would be parties before the ball when the young men would be invited. For example, we would have, if we had two girls staying with us, we'd have them down for drinks beforehand, before we went out to the ball, and then there would be parties after the dance. And things would go on at 4 or 5 in the morning. And it was all good fun. The mess itself would be very completely decorated with whatever you had to decorate. There's no debate about the buttons and colorful decorations. And again, that was part of the training, was to
improvise.
Yeah, to improvise and make a big show. You'd have to get it in the orchestra in from Toronto or something like that.
How large an orchestra would you get?
How large? Oh, fairly small. It's maybe 6 feet.
Was there not a band on at base?
Yes, but it was a bugle band.
Ah, so a bugle only.
Yeah, pipe and drum. Mm. So it would not be very suitable. And that band, the bugle was rather prominent in the life of a station like that. Because you would hear it in the morning, it was blown to
wake you up,
and it was blown at other times of the day to put you to sleep. And the bugle band led the parade. There was a separation of about half a mile between the barrack area and the quarters area and the working area. And the troops formed up in the parade ground, which was down there by the accommodation area, and they marched off to the working area. Daily. Mm. So the band would be leading off. And the trick was to get to get moving ahead of the parade, because the roads were rather narrow. Local regulation was you couldn't pass the marching troops If you got behind the marching troops, you had to just stay behind. You couldn't move past them.
And you couldn't go on the outskirts of the road.
No, if you did that, you threw up a cloud of dust. Mm-hmm. Although the road itself is paved, you'd be often buried in cyan dust. So I remember on one occasion, this back leader that I spoke to about, he was very strict on this road. He was always thinking of the troops and looking after them. He saw a car pass where it shouldn't pass that parade. Another thing, where the bugle band was going on, the troops couldn't hear a car coming up, and the car had to be awfully close to them, so there was a slight danger striking him. I was in the car with actually, I generally avoided getting in a car with a man driver. I thought this would be safe since the parade was on the road, and we'd be forced to drive at like 7 miles an hour. And when this car passed the parade, he took off. He knew a way of getting up. It was a trail. It went off about 45 degrees from the main road. It was a dirt trail, two ruts. Mm-hmm. It went around a pond and went away out on the bombing ranges and came up over a sand ridge and put his foot to the floor. And he was determined he was going to get down there before this, by the securities route, before this fellow who had passed the parade. So he'd be able to nab him. And when he had his foot right on the floor the whole time, and we came up over that sand dunes at the end of the field, mm-hmm. and then we'd be a rise of about 12, 15, maybe 18 feet there, and gradual upslope, and then a sudden downslope, and everything. We took off into the atmosphere, and we were four wheels in the air. And it landed reasonably on the four wheels, so we didn't upset, but it was sort of like this.
Yeah. Bit of a rumble.
And we managed to intercept this fellow on board. He had his strip torn off him by the old act. Yeah, well, now there was a... let me see what else about life in the States. And there, of course, there were... one was encouraged to participate in athletics and sports.
Mm-hmm.
That was one of the pastimes, and that was a remote place like that. There was a good football team.
Would it be all officers, or...?
No, football would be mixed. There was only one tennis court, which didn't provide too much scope. That was down by in front of the officers' mess. It was a concrete court,
mm-hmm.
which was it wasn't painted green. Or anything like that to soften it.
Mm-hmm.
The glare on it was terrible on those hot summer days.
Mm-hmm.
And the reflected heat was great. There was a badminton. I'm sorry, badminton was one of the popular games of the day. I played a fair amount of badminton there. I used to play against Jim Clark, who lived up one floor above me. I remember when he reported into Camp Borden, but joined the Army about 4 or 5 years after I did. And he was very energetic and agile on the court. We had a lot of fun together. He became the chief of the general staff, and I became chief of the air staff, which was kind of interesting. And we are living side by side here in this building.
Who won the games of badminton, you or he?
He was generally the winner, although we had great... Yeah. Hockey, of course, was a popular game.
You're talking about ice hockey.
And yes, ice hockey. And that would be another task for a junior officer to be manager of the hockey team, arrange schedules, and supervise the games both at home and away, and so on.
Was there an ice rink on base?
Yeah, not artificial, but it was nice.
But not
let me see. I can't remember. I don't think there was an ice rink. No, we played outside.
Yeah. And would you be playing at junior hockey teams or other men's?
Well, we played some pretty good hockey teams, about the OHA level.
Mm-hmm.
We played at Barrie and Aurelia and Midland, and those towns. City Central Convention and having all those good games. The football was high standard, high caliber, because we had Dave Harding there, who had been the kingpin on that famous Queens team. And, we played Balmy Beach, which was one of the Hamilton teams. I don't know whether it was the forerunner of the Tiger Cats or not, but it was a very dirty, rugged, rough bunch of Boilermakers. Came from, a lot of them were steel plant workers in Hamilton.
Did you play on either of the teams, hockey or football?
No, I didn't play on either of those, in either of those sports. I had played a bit of hockey, but I wasn't good enough to make those teams. They had pretty good players in the hockey team.
Mm-hmm.
And football was not one of my games. I had played rugger a bit, but I hadn't become acquainted with Canadian football.
Yeah.
I think that probably accounts for the... They were, of course, in the gym. Badminton was played in the gym, and there were all sorts of gymnastics encouraged.
Mm-hmm.
Another pastime, which was compulsory because it had to do with one's professional training in a sense, although it was a sport as well, was skeet shooting, trap shooting. And in those days, I guess it was straight trap shooting. Later, it became skeet shooting. That was encouraged, and you had to do it. We did it once a week.
It was to stimulate
your reactions and your quickness of movement and eye coordination and so on.
Mm-hmm. Effective, you think, or was it just a...
I think it was pretty good, yeah. Yeah. And you see, deflection shooting was important in those days. It was before the days of gyroscopic gun sights. And you therefore had to, when you were in combat, you had to be able to encompass the relative movement of the two aircraft and deflect your aim. And you had to do that in skeet shooting and trap shooting, too. So there was a good parallel there, and it was quite valuable, and it was also good fun.
Well, if you'd like, you could end it there, because you're getting very near the end of the tank.
Yeah, okay, fine.
And
another element of the... the entertainment. There was a small theater on.
A cinema theater?
Cinema. And there were movies once a week. It wasn't a movie every night. It was just a fresh movie one night a week, and that everybody went to it. The other ranks off the wives. Since there wasn't a great deal to do, it was well patronized.
Mm-hmm.
Well patronized. As far as the amenities, you might say the Camp Borden was about the size of a small town in a way with the Air Force gentlemen. But there weren't very many facilities in it. There was one small grocery store that was operated as a station store.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the... And it sold groceries, period. It didn't sell anything else. So all of the shopping that one, for example, the wives would want to do, clothing, that had to be done externally, and generally it was a good excuse for a trip to Toronto.
Yeah.
Three or four of the wives get together and go off to Toronto for the day. I don't think Barrie was considered quite the place, the fashion center. So Barrie and Allendale were the closest towns. And then, of course, social life. Yeah, I should mention also that there were summer resorts in that area at Wasaga Beach and at on Lake Simcoe. There were one or two, which varies on Lake Simcoe now. But there were a lot of summer cottages and a lot of summer life and activity, and the Air Force jets were invited over there quite frequently to private homes and to attend dances and parties and whatnot. That took Camp Borden slightly out of the remoteness that it otherwise would have existed, because you did see a fair number of people at these places. But again, they were 12, 15 miles away, and that was a greater, much greater distance in those days than it is now. And the roads in that area were all dirt roads. So you did tend to make your life right on the base, right on the station, and, with perhaps weekend excursions to these other, down to the next day.
Was there a direct...
Toronto was a great weekend spot. So
was it easy to get
King Henry Hotel was the, and it was before the days of the Royal Guard. King Henry Hotel was the hotel, and we made good use of it. Yeah, well, there we are. That's it.